Hey guys, my name is Alex, and you're listening to the Thousand Movie Project podcast. On Saturday, I went with Marie to see a new movie on South Beach. It's called Love Lies Bleeding. It is directed and co-written by Rose Glass, and I fucking loved it. And then I was surprised when I googled Rose Glass, the director, and I saw that she and I are the same age, which is fine. It doesn't mean anything. It's frightening. I don't like it. It is great that I can go and I can enjoy a movie. It's so much up my alley. It is so refined. And I find myself admiring the person who made this movie. It's a type of admiration that up until this point in my life, I've really only felt for older people. Older people, not because, you know, having survived a long time, I'm anointing them with any particular wisdom. Plenty of people get older without getting wiser. It's just that usually, if you're big into movies and books, it tends to be the case that with those two particular mediums, a person tends to have to spend a long time in the trenches, kind of demonstrating their initiative and their talent and their work ethic before a studio is ever going to be willing to trust them with the resources that it takes to make a mainstream piece of entertainment. And so to now find myself admiring the mainstream directorial efforts of someone who's an immediate contemporary is a little strange, but it's definitely exciting. Rose Glass was born in 1990, I was born in 1991, and those 2 years carve out what has been a group that's been called peak millennials. Those 2 years represent basically the baby boom of the millennial generation. 9 million babies born in the US between 1990 and 1992. The New York Times just had a podcast about it where they were interviewing one of their 32-year-old economists on the staff, and she sketched a portrait of what life is like for that group of peak millennials. That group started applying for college right when the recession hit. Colleges were hard hit by the recession. They couldn't accept as many students, and so competition for those college opportunities was fiercer than ever. If you did get accepted to your college of choice, like, you couldn't just not go. It was made to seem all the more unturned downable, and so peak millennials resorted to student loans. And it was because of activity in the years 2008 and 2009 that the largest form of debt in America, outside of mortgages, was student loan debt. People are desperate to get out of this economic slump. They take out huge loans so they can go to college and ensure that they can get a job once they're out. But then, once they're out of college, so are several millions of other people. So now there's this glut in the market of young talent willing to take little or no money at all, and now getting a job is more competitive than getting into school had been 4 years prior. And the economist who's describing this on The Daily, she cites this as the start of something I'd never heard of before, but I know what she's talking about, the barista with a bachelor's. The average age at which an American buys a home, apparently, is 31, but for this 2-year bracket of peak millennials, they were coming into their 30s just as the pandemic hit. I don't know why this makes me feel as though I belong to something exclusive. It's almost the exact opposite of belonging to something exclusive. I belong, so does Rose Glass, to a group that is defined by having too many people in it. But still, watching and loving Rose Glass's movie and then finding out that she belongs to the same exclusively inexclusive generational hill as I do, I am all the more stoked about her achievement. It feels like, I don't know, like a good friend of yours did it. But if there is that above-mentioned, like, gray gloss to all this, it's just like it's the old thing about, like, seeing the rising stars of your generation prompts you to kind of look around at your own situation and play the comparison game, which of course is useless. It is the thief of joy, but it does remind me. I'm reading a memoir right now by Bev Buisot-Stoll, S-T-O-L. It's called Chomsky and Me, and in this book she's talking about what it's been like to work as Noam Chomsky's sort of assistant slash manager slash coordinator for the past 24 years. And I've read a lot of this kind of book, the memoir of a person who was close for a long time to a person of interest. And Bev Stoll kind of breaks the unspoken taboo for some of these kinds of books, which is that, yes, you're selling us your quote-unquote memoir, so it's all your story about your life, but you have this famous person's name in the title of your book, you have their face on the cover of your book, and what nobody wants to admit is that we, the reader, want to violate this famous person's privacy by hearing what they told you in confidence, and you, the alleged memoirist, want your 15 minutes of fame by violating that confidence. And so the unspoken pact here is the reader forks over money, and the author tells their life story in a way that kindly does not dwell very much on themselves. Bev Stoll breaks that rule. She talks quite a bit about her own pursuits and her personal life, but it ended up hooking me in a way that I wouldn't have guessed, because she talks about getting this job in Noam Chomsky's office. He's a famous linguist, political activist, scholar. She doesn't know who he is when she starts working there, but she recognizes pretty much immediately that she's working with a major figure. Not just a major figure of the academic landscape at MIT, but a figure of, like, global importance. And she sees that, like, yeah, he's this distracted dude. He's always wearing unassuming tweed sweaters, and he apparently still only eats white food. Unremarkable on the surface, but then on 9/11, for instance, she says that Chomsky was flooded with interview requests, people wanting his perspective on how these attacks happened, who were the most likely perpetrators, how is America likely to respond, and he took pretty much all of those interview requests. He was up until the early morning hours giving interviews with people all over the world. And it was from these kinds of encounters that Stoll could see that Chomsky wasn't just a brilliant guy whose intellect people fetishized and tried to emulate, although he was that. She saw that people kind of turned to this dude for guidance and for comfort when things were, you know, terrifying around the world. He was capable of providing it, and he worked very hard to do so. And so Stoll talks about realizing that the longer she stays working with Chomsky, which is very compelling and it's very rewarding, the more she is surrendering the likelihood of ever sort of grabbing on to her own professional ambitions, which were to become a therapist. She even uses the language that is cringy in the way that I guess it's kind of accurate, and it just sounds so melodramatic, but she was saying basically, like, she's surrendering her own personally rewarding middle-of-the-road pursuits in order to be instrumental in the life of a great figure. For better or for worse, I'm only at the 100-page mark, but she seems to have dropped that issue entirely. Noam Chomsky is still alive, as of the book's publication and as of this recording. Plus, Bev Stoll is a comedian, and the book is clearly trying to be light and funny. Also, so naturally she's not going to pursue that kind of angsty navel-gazing. Also, I think it's very likely that even now, in her 60s, she probably hasn't quite figured it out. And that might be fine, because she seems like the kind of person who exists in between spaces. She talks about her hobby of woodworking, performing stand-up, writing comedy. She teaches a night school class on electrical wiring just for women. And also, the part of me that wishes for a little more angst on the page is kind of at odds with the part of me that wants this to be what it claims to be, which is a book about Noam Chomsky, who incidentally has a new book out, sort of. I just got a review copy of it. The publisher was nice enough to send me a PDF, and only when I opened it did I realize it's mostly a reprint. Noam Chomsky is 93 years old, and so, as you can imagine, he's not really writing 3 or 4 books a year, which appears to be his rate of publication. These things are all kind of stretched out and, like, fluffed out to 180 pages around there, but they're still enjoyable. I got a review copy of one of his books about 3 years ago. 3 or 4 years ago, it was co-authored, but Noam Chomsky's name was there at the top of the front cover. The book itself, I should say, is called Between Thought and Expression Lies a Lifetime, Why Ideas Matter. So I open it up, the first section is called Correspondence 1, and I thought, that's cool too. It'll be like a formal dialogue between two scholars, they'll be trading barbs about their ideas. Because I had just fallen in love with a wonderful book just like that. It's an exchange of letters between Paul Auster and J.M. Coetzee called Here and Now. I've got a copy here, and when I open it up, the first underlined passage I see is a Groucho Marx quote. Outside of a dog, a book is a man's best friend. Inside of a dog, it is too dark to read. But so, I get into this correspondence, and it starts as follows. Dear Mr. Kelman, thanks for your invitation to Glasgow. The idea of visiting the Free University and Scotland generally is very appealing. He then talks for a page about how busy he is, how he's probably not going to be able to make it. Then, on the next page, he writes this. Dear Mr. Kelman, thanks to some rearrangements, cancellations, and reschedulings, I have finally been able to arrange to visit Glasgow. And so they talk about this literary festival or academic conference thing that they're putting on, all the logistics about when and how Chomsky will arrive, what he'll do when he gets there, who's going to pick him up, what speech he's going to give, what topics they'll address. They're going back and forth planning this trip, and then, a few pages later, we get this. Dear Mr. Kelman, Professor Noam Chomsky is away from MIT for the summer months, and I am writing for him to let you know that your letter was received here at this office. I am sorry for the form letter, but it is the most efficient way we have found to deal with the large volume of mail he receives. Your letter will be forwarded to Professor Chomsky as soon as possible. However, because of rerouting, it may be several weeks before you receive a response. We appreciate your patience. In the meantime, if you have any questions that I might be able to answer, feel free to contact me at the address above or by telephone at 617-253-7819. Jamie Young, Secretary, MIT Linguistics. 30 pages of this. 30 pages of mundane trip planning correspondence, and not even half of the letters are from Noam Chomsky. But it's still fun to get this shit. Like, it's fodder for fans. One of the delights in reading any of Chomsky's books is he has given so many interviews and lectures at this point that whatever you are reading, you can hear it in Chomsky's voice.
We may forget that it wasn't until 1975, not that long ago, that women were granted the right of persons, peers, under U.S. domestic law.
That Kissingerian monotone.
That no problem ever gets finally solved. That every solution is an entry ticket to a new set of problems.
I don't think Henry Kissinger would have ever sat for a conversation with Chomsky, though I'm sure Chomsky would have leapt at the opportunity to confront Henry Kissinger in a conversation, but I've always wanted to see the two of them go at it, preferably the Chomsky and Kissinger of their respective 90s.
So there was a major women's movement, probably the major movement of the past half century. How did it start? Go back to the, of course it goes way back, but...
From the beginning, there was a difference in our relationship with China, then with many other countries.
Go back to the 50s. Again, goes far back. 50s,
not
Rosa Parks
for Americans
refused to move her seat on the bus.
On
that
the
was planned. It was an organized effort by activists who planned the activity.
We are very
led to the
pragmatic.